It is Saturday, February 21st, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news and your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have geeks. Al Luckow, he is a new media architect. Morning, Al.
Good morning.
Miles Elam. Miles Elam is a student and political junkie. Hi.
Good morning.
Are you still a programmer?
Yes, I still program.
Oh, good.
Just, I don't get paid for it. I do it for a class, though. I'm taking Intro to Data Structures.
And how's that going?
I unfortunately missed my perfect score. I messed up on reading some requirements. So
oh, darn
it. It's still pretty easy, but I'm not going to get the A+ that I was really hoping for.
Epic fail. Okay, and we also have Ben Jaffe, freelance media dude.
Morning.
Good morning, Ben. You're very perky and smiley today. What's going on?
I don't know. I was just laughing about what we were talking about earlier, but I can't remember what that is anymore. And now I'm just laughing.
Humor just sticks, huh?
It's in his cash.
Very programming geeky. That's good. Hi, Al. I'm going to start with you.
Okay. It hasn't really been the most productive week for me this week due to the acacias blooming.
Oh.
And the tons and tons of pollen that are all going into the air and inside my nose. But it got me curious about what kinds of geeky things happen this time of year. So I found a few interesting things that happened on or around this week in geek history.
Okay.
So one of them that kind of, you know, was important to me happened in 1974. Nolan Bushnell was issued a patent for a video image positioning control system. And this was for his Pong Home video game system. Now, for the new legions of technorati out there who have never heard the screech of a 14.4 modem or seen ASCII art, maybe, Lyle, you could explain to them what Pong is, since you're so good at explaining things.
Okay.
Yeah, G. Lyle, what is Pong? I've never heard of it.
You've never even heard of it, right, Ben?
Oh,
you're,
no.
You were born after 74.
And what's ASCII? Is that with a Y? No.
So Pong is kind of the de facto first video game. It's the one people talk about. It probably wasn't the first video game. It's a visual game where you have two bars that go to the left and the right of the screen, and they go up and down, and a human controls one and a computer controls another, or another human controls the other, and you're able to move it up and down. And then you have a ball up and down, and then you have a ball that bounces around the screen, and the general idea is that you keep the ball from going through your goal. So it's very much like ice hockey on a computer.
The ball goes back and forth, and the paddles go up and down.
And originally, do you understand that now,
originally
Ben?
This ball was square.
Yes.
It was a square ball. Imagine
that.
It
did not bounce like a square ball. Well, it kind of did. Any case, so he had this first patent for that game in 1974. Mm-hmm. Is that the? I mean, assuming that's the first video game patent.
It was actually the patent was really on the computer controller to control it doing the things. I mean, I don't think he necessarily. Right. I mean, Pong is very similar to ping pong. So I don't think he patented the game, but the
I guess
way
that's
it's
a better analysis.
On,
I think of it as more like ice hockey because it's got that two-dimensional feel.
It is more like ice hockey, actually.
Bouncing. But now, the thing that's interesting about Pong now is that it has become kind of the get someone interested in programming, let's make Pong again. It's kind of that standard game that you generate. You did that when you were teaching Stanford last summer, right, Ben?
Yeah, we made Pong Out, which is Breakout and Pong together. Oh, boy.
Ooh, fun. So it's like Pong, but there's bricks in the middle.
Well, you trick the kids. You say, okay, do you want to make Pong or Breakout? And then they, you know, both, some people go for Pong, some people go for Breakout. And then you say, well, what if we make both in one game? Oh,
my
God.
Wow, I want you to be a teacher for
me. I had that game.
See, if I had that class, I would have gotten an A+.
All right, Pong. All right, Lyle, computer programming, right?
That's right, computer programming.
No, you'd be teaching me that, not me, you.
Ah, I see. Okay, let's move on. Well, give me one other thing that happened.
Well, I mean, as long as we're talking about video games, on February 20th, Ken Chevalier, age 16, in 1982, scored 12,900,000 points on Atari's Battlezone game after playing for 12 hours at the Star Station 101 arcade in Atascadero, California.
Is that the game that was kind of like a 3D game where you drove forward with a tank and you shot other tanks?
It's the first 3D game that I remember ever seeing. It was all kind of, you know, it wasn't, I mean, kids nowadays are going to look at this and go, what the, you know, that's not. But what it really was like line art. It was all wireframe.
Right. Yeah.
And it was green. The wires were green and everything else was black. And when you blew up tanks, they blew up in all these little three-dimensional wireframe chunks and then bounced on the ground.
Yeah.
I think you put your head in like a little goggle thing too.
Don, did you ever play that game?
Oh yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Everyone, these are happening games. You know, these are the people that are in power now. By the way, kids, people who have played Pong and Battlezone.
All right. The other thing about these games that are really interesting is that the computing power to do these are so simple. Like, really, any programming environment can create these games. I haven't seen a remake of that game for, like, my iPhone, though that would be kind of fun.
Well, a lot of these games you haven't seen. Some of the games, like your Ben was mentioning Breakout. Oddly enough, the history of Breakout is that Woz had originally designed that game for Atari. And they had the game for a long time, and, you know, there's like, a lot of stories and folklore around that. But essentially, Atari wanted to upgrade the game or redo the game a couple years later, and they took apart Woz's thing, and they pretty much couldn't figure out how it worked.
Oh, really?
So they had to start all over again because they just weren't able to understand how he was able to make it work. It was kind of an interesting related thing. And then one last thing in history. Yeah. There's a lot of things happen in history, but one of the things I thought was interesting was that Apple Computer registered the internet domain name apple.com in 1987, and it was one of the first 100 companies to register a .com domain.
Wow, in 87.
Yeah, a .com domain back in the time of Reagan.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
That's weird, huh?
I wonder when I first got my domain. I think it was 97. You had one more, though, in 1946. Go ahead and do that one, too. I think
1946 was interesting. That was the first transition, or it was the first transmission of a television signal, successful transmission from Washington D.C. to New York City over an AT&T coaxial cable. And that happened in 1946. On this day,
it's a long time ago.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Alan, for that. Miles, let's go to you. Sure.
There's always something going on in Congress. Most of the news has been occupied with the stimulus package, the pros and the cons, and it being voted on, and what's the fallout going to be. But I want to talk about something that's a bit more geeky, but off to the side, hasn't gotten much attention. There's a bill being proposed that would force ISPs and home users to keep Wi-Fi logs for police subpoena later. So in other words, if you have a coffee shop with a Wi-Fi hotspot, or if in your home you have a Wi-Fi network without a password protection on it, then you are required to keep logs of who is connecting to you and where they're going.
Wait.
For 2 years.
Who all has to do this?
Everyone with an open Wi-Fi hotspot.
Is this bill going to pass?
Don't know. It depends on how much people... how many people call their local representative and let them know what they think. Depends on how many representatives understand the issue.
The general idea behind this would be, if I have an open wireless connection in my neighborhood, my next door neighbor starts looking at child pornography through my network. Mm-hmm. Then they come and talk to me about it, and I go, it wasn't me, it was somebody else using my network, and they say, show me the logs.
Exactly.
And I don't have the logs, so I'm responsible.
That's how the bill is being proposed right now, is talking about we need to protect the kids from
right. Well, that's I mean, that's the ultimate... you know, that's the magic.
The ultimate taboo, the ultimate, you know, access key to doing stuff like
that. So I understand that idea, but the problem is that those systems don't keep logs.
Right.
Like my wireless network, I can't do that. I have to put up another. It'd be very complex for me to try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically would close down the networks. Who's sponsoring the bill?
It's a fair number of people, including Senator John Conyer. Conyen.
I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. Who's paying for this bill to be passed? Meaning, I would assume that it's ISPs, because if ISP can close down people's open wireless, that means more people have to buy wireless.
On the contrary, this is very much a we have to protect the children measure. I don't know if people have thought too much of who's going to pay for the fallout. I think this is more of like the moral certainty to say this has to be done.
the idea to say we want to restrict the way people access knowledge because some people will do things that
not
we feel is inappropriate.
To log it.
Effectively, it will stop it because the systems don't exist to log it.
Right.
Now, the idea that I'd have to start logging all the traffic that goes through my network is insane.
Right. Well, it's insane because you understand the problem.
Yeah.
So for folks out there, just if you're kind of figuring, well, maybe you should log it, maybe it isn't. Imagine you just bought that nice $120 terabyte hard drive, nice spanking new huge storage that you were going to use for completely legal MP3s or movies or the like.
Archiving GeekSpeak episodes.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Except those aren't that big, but yeah. Once we go to a video podcast, then we'll start getting bigger.
Okay. Any case.
At any rate, logs, if you're handling every single access, every single person that's connected to your system, where they've gone, necessary for if you were subject to a police subpoena to say, no, this wasn't me, this was this other person, this is how you need to find them, it would require a login. I mean, you're going to be using that terabyte hard drive just for maintenance purposes, not for actually doing anything that you want.
It's that much data.
Well, think of you have a log saying this IP address, this location.
Right. It's every location access. It's not actually every server even. It's every unique URL. That's what you need to log.
Probably. I'll have to look at the details to it. But
I mean, it would compress pretty well.
Right,
but logs are big problems. I mean, I remember talking to.
But you have to keep it, and this is also for you have to retain this data for 2 years.
That's insane.
That's the kicker. That's why you have to have all the space.
So I'd have to close down my wireless access point and not make it open.
I think that's the idea.
Right. So here's the point, though, is that.
Is it ISPs that are saying trying to get them?
That's
to,
what I'm
to
thinking
that
is
down.
It might be them that's trying to say this is a good idea because of course if I can't use my neighbor's wireless, I'm going to have to buy some kind of.
Now bear in mind, this is also requiring ISPs. To keep logs about where people are going.
Right.
As well.
I've always kind of wondered about this because, like, I let my friends come over and they were using their iPhone. And you could be doing anything in my house on my wireless, but I'm the one responsible. So I get that idea. You're inviting someone to potentially do something pretty bad in your environment. So if I could log it, then I wouldn't have to trust you. And that'd be nice, not having to trust you, Miles. What I'm saying is it produces this level of... I don't want to live in that kind of society. Anyway, thank you very much for that story. I'm going to contact my Congress representative and say don't vote on that because I think it's a stupid bill.
Vote on it, just vote no.
Vote no, right. I don't know how that whole thing works. Thank you, political junkie Miles. Ben, hi.
Hi. I briefly just want to say that last episode, I asked for people to be my Valentine.
Did you get anyone?
Well, first of all, I got you.
I did during the show.
Sent me a piece of paper that said, be mine, Ben. It was
really I listened sweet. To the episode, too.
But... It was really sweet.
Oh, good.
A tear came to my eye. But really, really, it did. But anyway, thank you, Judith, for your Valentine's Day.
Judith from Watsonville, Judith?
I don't know.
Oh,
I don't know. Also, thank you, Mom and Dad. Thank you, Al. I'm not going to list everyone, but
how many people?
I got 10. I got 10 Valentines.
You got more than me.
I got 11.
I got
Valentines.
No Valentines.
Oh no.
Yeah. There you go.
Wait.
And
no,
I'm married.
I blew you a kiss after you. No.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
Anyway, moving on from that.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. So Facebook has gotten itself in. Got itself into a tough position and recently got itself back out of it. They changed their terms of use and they replaced – so there was a sentence in their terms of use that said that Facebook couldn't claim any rights to original content that any users uploaded after the user closed their account. But they took out that sentence and they replaced it with, quote, you may remove your user content from the site at any time. However, you acknowledge that the company may retain archived copies of your user content. And that the web kind of exploded with people saying, whoa, this is not okay. That they're basically saying in no uncertain terms that they can hold on to your original content for as long as they see fit, even if you delete your account. So, and Facebook's reasoning was, what if you post someone on, or what if you post something on someone's wall and then you delete your account? Does it remove it from the person's wall?
Let me try to explain Facebook just a little bit because a lot of people don't use it and therefore wouldn't know what a wall means. The general idea of Facebook is everybody that participates has an account, and they have a space that's them, like a page that represents them, their profile page or their wall. And other people that are friends of theirs can add content to that wall. So, for example, when Al did a video recently, he posted a video about like behind-the-scenes GeekSpeak stuff. I wrote on his wall, thanks, Al, for doing that. So now my content's showing up on Al's page and on other places as well. That's the general idea. So what Facebook is saying is, if we don't do that and I erase my account, theoretically that little thing that went onto Al's page that made it a better and richer experience for him
should be deleted forever.
It should be deleted forever, yeah. Or should it stay?
Yeah, and so it seems
so
like
funny
it,
how quickly copyright
like
becomes strange and yeah. weird in this situation, because that little text is I theoretically own the copyright as soon as I create that, and yet Al's publishing it right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, if Facebook's really publishing
it. And so it seems like from one perspective, it seems like that should stay because it's part of Al's wall in a sense,
yeah.
right? It's not your content. But from a legal standpoint, it is. And that's why Facebook's kind of
So the other issue, of course, is that people are making journals for themselves that no one else is actually reading on their Facebook account. And when they delete the account, they don't want Facebook to have that.
Yeah, or uploading photos from a vacation.
Photos, for example, or that video that Al put up, right? If he does erase it, who owns that video at that point? But the thing that gets me on these is that, of course, Facebook's going to have trouble deleting something. They have backup solutions. So right off the bat, it's going to be hard to get rid of stuff. Miles?
Now, is this really talking about copyright, or is this talking about licensing? That they have a license to publish. That is different than ownership.
Well, if they're saying they get to keep it indefinitely,
they use the word perpetuity.
Yeah, but that is an indefinite time period license to publish that content.
Yeah, it's not saying that they own it.
Right,
yeah. saying
right.
That
you
they
still
will
control
publish.
It. You've just released the ability for them to publish to that one vendor.
Now, yes. I said they put themselves in this tough position. They recently pulled back and reversed that decision on their policy. So now that line is no longer there, which is kind of good news, but at the same time, it's kind of a complex issue. You know, like it seems like it should be a relatively simple issue, but it's not. It's when you look at it from both of those perspectives, you can see both very easily. So
thank you, Ben. Well,
and that also raises the question of your Gmail account. If you delete your Gmail account, does your email go away? I'm not sure that it does.
Right.
But people made a big deal about Facebook because they had that change and they had the immediate thing to think about it. But this is true for just about any service you go online
right.
with, whether it be LiveJournal or...
Email's a really interesting and kind of tricky one, too, mm-hmm. because you're not controlling what goes into your account. Other people send stuff to your account. And then if you delete it or not, it's still there. That comes back down to that question of, you know, child pornography, with that giant taboo of, if somebody else has my email address, they can give me stuff into my account that I don't want to see. And then if I delete it, Gmail might still retain it. It's a very strange space.
It's like a mailbox, though. You know, someone could put something in your mail slot as well.
Right,
and then
I can throw that away immediately, or I can take it to the police, I guess.
Well, that's true, but you can throw away email as well.
Yeah, but Google won't get rid of it, and it'll always be attached to you.
I see what you're saying.
You just got to, if you're going to be on the internet, you just have to realize, just going somewhere in a web page, everything's being recorded, making web pages. I mean,
right.
I can go back to websites that I've designed in like 98 in the Wayback Machine in archive.org.
Right.
It has it right there. Exactly. Well, not exactly, but pretty close to all the artwork that I did. It's all just floating right there.
Except that you can tell the Wayback Machine, delete this old stuff of mine. It's under copyright and I haven't given you a license to it. People have done that, which actually I think is kind of a bad thing, because then you're getting rid
right.
of this history.
And plus it would take forever in my case.
Yeah, but people still do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a different thing from that in perpetuity, saying you have giving us a license to publish and you can't revoke it.
Well, so, okay. Thank you very much for that story, guys. That was great. What else can happen with email, Al?
Well, actually, I ran across this interesting story.
The birth of octuplets.
What was that?
No.
I ran across this interesting story of a case of somnambulism, or as Dr. Don pointed out to me today, it could also be called autonomotism. And basically what that is sleepwalking, but this person was emailing while asleep.
Oh, no.
You know, I mean, my opinion, I think I could get a lot done that way, but apparently it's some, they're saying it's some kind of disability now.
What does the email say?
Well, the males, it was a woman. Uh-huh. And they said the males themselves were perhaps not up to the woman's waking standard. Each was in a random mix of upper and lowercase characters, badly formatted and containing odd expressions.
Oh, they did have English, though.
Well, yeah. One read, "Come tomorrow and sort this hellhole out." Another one, "Dinner and drinks at 4 p.m. Bring wine and caviar only." Another said simply, "What the?" I mean,
so these are email. Basically, the person's not really waking up, sleepwalking, goes in, turns on the computer, yep. starts emailing people, sends it. The next day, people are like, "What?
Yeah,
what did you just do?"
That's great. Do you guys remember the story a couple weeks ago about emailing when you're drunk? And there's an application you can install that will
delay that's emails. That's in Gmail.
It's in Gmail.
It's in Gmail, where you have to do basic algebra.
You can turn this on.
Really? Yeah. You have to solve basic algebra.
So that would solve this problem. I think it's hilarious. I mean, as long as it's not something inappropriate.
Oh well, I mean, you know, my emails are kind of unintelligible anyway. But if I had to do algebra before, I don't know if I could. That would really filter out my emails a lot.
All right. Thanks for the update on crazy email. Miles, you're up next, sir.
I am. I don't have anything ready.
Oh, really? Okay, well, then hang on a second. I'll go to Ben. And Ben, I know you've got something ready.
Oh, yeah. I have a silly news story.
I like this one.
Speaking of the cat one?
Yeah.
So speaking of terms of service and agreeing to license agreements and privacy policies.
Right, because when you actually made the Facebook entry, you did say something that
yes.
you didn't read.
When I signed up, I said I agree to the terms of use. And the terms of use said we can change these terms of use whenever we want.
Right.
So I effectively said I agree to whatever
you can
you
take
guys,
my first unborn child.
You know, every one of those things, anytime somebody sends you one of those little apps like, have a drink on me, you like accept it and says, if you accept this, you're agreeing to let everybody in the world see everything you have ever done, you know.
Yeah,
but it's like, is it just me or I mean,
well, I say no to those
I just like I don't if you're gonna send me a drink, send me a real drink, you know. Throw a snowball at me. I don't get really what's happening. And
that's on Facebook. You can throw a virtual I almost said throw a virtual drink, throw a virtual snowball, or give a virtual
Ben's
drink.
Already been drinking.
Apparently, that's a super
and every one of them has some like long-term, you know, agreement you have to sign in order to get. I just, you know, I'm like, I just stopped, you know, accepting things like that. I have enough.
I don't accept them either. But yeah.
Well, if you don't want to accept them, you can do what mispronounce her name, Anne Lux did. She actually made a very, very simple. She basically took a piece of cardboard and put a small piece of cardboard on the back. She used this as a button and draped it across her keyboard. So whenever you push down on this huge button, it presses the space bar, right? Then you open up your web browser or your installer or something, get the focus for the space bar on the button, I agree, and then you get your cat to walk across the button. And the cat effectively agrees to the end user license agreement. So
wait,
theoretically,
saying,
you could argue that you're not, but that yeah.
So the idea is that you're about to install software, you put this little pad thing on top of your thing, then you go and make some tea, and at some point the cat's just going to walk across it, well, hits the space bar, accepts it, you come back, it's been accepted, and you can go on.
Well, she actually bribes the cat there.
Oh, that, no, you
no,
can't
but,
do the
but listen,
bribing
but listen,
the cat.
Bribes the cat to near the button, and then pets the cat and whatever, and then the cat happens to walk over the button on its own free will. Awesome. So that's the argument that she could make. But it would be a lot more powerful if you just trained your cat to go run over your keyboard every half an hour or something.
Not trained.
You can't train
your cat.
Not
trained.
I have a cat. You can't bribe her to do anything.
Yes, but does your cat go out a cat door?
My cat does whatever she wants to do when she wants to do it. So if she's signing up for stuff on Facebook... I have
totally
no control
not your responsibility.
Over it. I can't stop her.
I think that's fantastic. The idea of those user agreements is pretty ridiculous, and that shows the ridiculous number. Though, you do own that cat, and therefore you're responsible for its actions.
I don't know. You,
I think you need to take someone else's cat and do it with someone else's cat.
My cat agreed to this end user license agreement, not me argument probably wouldn't actually hold up in court. It'd probably be pretty easy to
Are you? Wait,
it's funny.
We'll probably have to ask Schrodinger.
It's a really neat idea. You know?
Unless you don't watch the cat do it. It doesn't
unless the cat navigated to the site and then filled out the EULA without your knowledge, that would hold up. But just setting everything up just in case something gets tipped over, it's like putting a glass of milk on the edge of the table and then letting your toddler run free and saying, like, I didn't knock it over. The toddler knocked over the glass of milk.
Yeah.
Next news story. Well, Miles, are you ready now?
I need to make a correction, actually, on the previous story. You don't have to keep every URL that you go to, which does change the storage requirements dramatically. All you need to do is keep track of who was assigned a particular IP address by DHCP at any given moment.
But that doesn't work because that IP address doesn't go all the way to the servers, does it?
That's the whole point, is that you need to be able to differentiate, like, what's the MAC address that was assigned to that IP address the request going out.
Okay, let me ask you something about the network stack then. If my wireless hub is giving a whole bunch of internal IP addresses to you, your cell phone and my computer, and then you access the internet through that, the IP address that they see doesn't have your local IP address, does it?
No, I get they don't, but the issue here is that you would require a whole new hardware. You would need to buy a new router gateway that had some ability to log that information.
But that's the thing is, no, actually, my network does have a page that shows status and when it's set up and shows IP address that it gives out. And all I'd have to do is write a script to pool that every hour and log and save it.
Do all of them do that?
Pretty much all the ones I know that do DHCP, yeah, they tell you what clients have requested IPs.
And people who have problems setting up their wireless with passwords.
No, it's not a good answer, but at least I can handle it. I don't care what other people. No, the thing is, I don't think that actually does anything, because then if I have 50 people using my, you know, that have IP addresses internally, and then I access the internet, do the packets that come back actually have your local IP in them?
They would have some state information, but...
Would it know that it was going to go to you? Meaning, you're in a subnet 10.0.0.1,
right? For a NAT, it wouldn't work. For an ISP where they're giving you DHCP, but it's a public IP address, it would work.
But the public IP address from DHCP never goes through my wireless. My wireless is always just one IP.
Right. That means it's NATed, and you would have an issue. You're right.
And so, who knows about the NAT packet? Who knows that the packet's going back to you because it has an ID on it?
Well, it has to have some state information.
I think it has your MAC address or your IP address.
No,
doesn't it?
No,
doesn't have your MAC
address.
It doesn't
have that information. It has a identifier.
Yeah, it gets
to be able to say because the translation table is kept on the router itself to be
right.
able to say this identifier came back. This is going to this is
you'd have to log that
they went
you'd
to.
Have to log that too. Okay. Anyway, thanks for the clarity on that. Let's go on to something else, please.
Right. Now, speaking of tech and going off on the web and trying to record that, there is a mini revolution going on in Europe, starting in Finland, where people really, really don't like Internet Explorer version 6. They don't want to support it anymore.
This is like a political revolution. I got all serious. I'm like, wait, what's he going here? People are dying in the thousands.
No.
So people really dislike Internet Explorer 6.
Well, more to the point that Internet Explorer 6 is now this holdout. Internet Explorer 7 being better, not great, but still better. Where you have all these new technologies, all these ways to make web pages better, either more dynamic, more rich, use less bandwidth, things like that, that you just cannot do with Internet Explorer 6. You have to do all of this extra effort, have to retool the site, change your CSS file, maybe change some markup to make it work with this one browser that is waning in usage. That is now, how old is it now? 7 years old?
No. IE6 is 7 years old?
6 years old, something like that.
That's insane.
2003.
Okay, so what are they doing about it? They hate
like
it. I understand hating it. I hate IE6.
So what
too.
They're doing is they're setting up websites where if the browser comes in, you can check to see what type of browser it is. If the browser
the
comes
user
in,
agent string?
Yes.
Okay, go on.
If the browser's user agent string comes in saying this is Internet Explorer 6, they send back a page that isn't the actual page they requested, but rather a variations on your browser is horrible here, upgrade it.
Interesting. So websites are deciding that, you know what, we're not going to serve to IE6 anymore, and we're going to tell you to upgrade. And theoretically, if a site that you really like well enough does that, you'll upgrade. Like, here's a question. If Google did that, wouldn't everybody just upgrade to IE7?
Yes, but it would be hard for them to do because Google wants to support everyone. But this is also coming into play that
there's a bill I can support. There's a bill I can support. Websites have to help people upgrade their non-secure stuff.
But more to the point, Internet Explorer 6 is less secure than Internet Explorer 7. By using that older version, Microsoft is not putting in the same effort for securing it and putting patches into play. And also vendors who are putting JavaScript libraries that work with a browser aren't
right.
watching Internet Explorer 6 as closely as they are the newer versions. So
right.
it actually is an issue, not just in terms of speed and feature set, but in terms of security profile.
Thank you very much, Miles, for that. Do you think we should do it for the GeekSpeak site or for other sites? Just turn off IE6 support? I mean, not that
I don't
it works
we
for IE6 anyway.
I was thinking more along the lines of how we do it right now, which is if IE6 breaks, it breaks.
Ah, I see.
But it would be nice to have a message to say, if this doesn't look right, it means you're on the wrong browser.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. We're going to go ahead and take a call, because it's always fun to do that on GeekSpeak. If I can figure out how to push everything right. Michelle and Ben Lohman? Michael and Ben Lohman.
Hi.
Hi. Sorry about that. What's up?
Yeah, I got a couple of questions and also a comment of my experience that might be useful.
Okay.
I found personally that after checking several spam blockers that I really like Cloudburst. So I just thought I'd mention that.
Cloudburst?
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a look at it.
The other thing is I'm noticing that the internet seems to be very difficult to launch on Mozilla Firefox sometimes. Is there a situation where the internet is actually overloaded and that's why it doesn't load quickly enough?
No. But yes, kind of.
But you're finding that the web is slower when you're using Firefox rather than Internet Explorer?
Is there a reason why I'm using Firefox?
No, I mean, are you finding actually that Firefox is slower as compared to like Internet Explorer?
No, I was told by my computer wizard that basically Internet Explorer was an inferior product to Firefox.
Yes.
So that's the reason why.
No, I'm just trying to differentiate whether or not changing to the browser slows things down,
right,
or whether or not
the first thing to do is actually find out where the problem is. And what Miles is kind of questioning is it your local computer that's having trouble running an application, and it's therefore one is slower than the other, and there's a difference between like Internet Explorer or Firefox on your machine. That's one thing you can think about. But the thing to do first, and Alex suggests, is to go ahead and check your bandwidth and see how fast it is. And that can be affected by a lot of things. If you're on DSL, for example, and you have a bad connection with your phone, you can actually slow your network down quite a bit. So there's a great little testing site that we use all the time. It's up on the GeekSpeak website right now for today's show. I'll just say the URL right now. It's speedtest.net. And you go up there with your browser from your home, wherever you want to test, and you click on it, and it actually starts sending packets back and forth and actually assesses how fast your machine is or your network is. And that will give you an idea of whether it's your network connection. Miles?
And I would suggest you do it once in Firefox and then do it once in Internet Explorer. And then you'd be able to see like exactly how much speed you're getting through each one.
I think
if it's the same for both browsers, it means that it doesn't have anything to do with your browser. It has to do with your Internet connection.
I think there's one thing that I would like to add. Michael, is your Wi-Fi system password protected?
Right.
Is it? It is password protected? If it's not password protected and you have a neighbor who also is browsing the web and
yes.
is downloading big movies, when they are doing that, it will slow your connection down. So,
is there any way of knowing that?
Kind of. You can look and see if who's connected, how many clients are connected to your wireless router. You do have a wireless router?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you get into the web interface, this is actually what Miles and I were just talking about a little while ago. There's a place in there for the local DHCP. Just look for DHCP or client list. And in that, you should see all the IP addresses that your wireless thing is handing out and the machine names, like the commuter names. So for
how do I get to local DHCP?
Well, if you've got to log into your wireless access point's web interface, and that's a little tricky to explain.
Can people come to your house and use their wireless laptop? Has anybody ever just come over and said, can I use and just open their laptop and connect
yes.
it? They have?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that means that you don't have a password, because otherwise they would ask you, hey, I can't get onto your network. What's your password? So you have an unsecured and you know, I mean, if you're in an area where there's a lot of houses or an apartment building or something, you really need to kind of secure your wireless, because people are just going to piggyback onto it and use your connection. If you're, you know, out in the woods somewhere, it doesn't really matter. But
I don't know if it's that big of an issue unless someone decides to start doing P2P apps using things like BitTorrent
there may be like certain times when lots of people are trying to log on that I might be
right.
Well, they're not trying to log on, they're using your network. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for the question. We're going to keep talking about it a bit, but your phone's kind of cutting out. So the basic idea, I do this every once in a while when my network seems to slow down at home, and it's very you know, there's a bit of this of kind of feels like it's slowing down, right? There's not like a test. I could run the test, of course. I'll go and take a look at my wireless access settings through the web interface and see if there's other computers that are connected and how long they've been connected to some degree. And what you can do at that point is you can set up the password protection on it. And enable it for a while, and then people stop using it and see if the tests improve. And I basically find that it doesn't normally affect the speed very much. So I'm thinking it's probably something else, but it could be that, of course.
Yeah. And Alex made a good point. It's not just P2P apps. Anyone piggybacking on you goes to YouTube, suddenly you're completely cut off.
Or Hulu, even more so.
Yeah.
From Aptos, Elizabeth, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick piece of geek news that's interesting. I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh, but I do listen to this very funny show on weekdays that makes fun of all the right-wing news and people. Mm-hmm. And that he actually, on his show, and they played the excerpt this week, said that the reason the stimulus package is only being released on the web in PDF is that you can't search a PDF for keywords, and so the program I was listening to immediately explained that that wasn't true and told what you need to do, but it was just another piece of misinformation from him that was interesting.
Well, he's an entertainer, right? He's just he's sort of like an online clown, kind of.
Well, he's giving the facts. I mean, in this excerpt they played, he wasn't trying to be funny or anything. He's trying to, you know, put down what the president's doing, and you know they're really trying to hide what's really in the stimulus packet.
I thought that was just like a big joke show, like a big
satire
joke.
It has influence.
Elizabeth, thank you. It's real. Elizabeth, thank you for the mention of it. Yeah, you can of course search PDFs, assuming that they're text PDFs, and almost they always are. And then the entire document is searchable. You need a reader that can do that. But even Google indexes PDFs online, so you could very easily search that document and actually get to an HTML version of it using Google.
Yeah, I don't know of a single PDF reader that can't do a find.
But speaking of... Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for the call. Bye-bye. Just a confirmation. Yeah, you can search PDFs. Rush Limbaugh is a big, fat idiot. Wait, that's a book. Sorry. That was just a book. That's not my opinion. Though, about Adobe Acrobat and Reader. Very interesting news hit this week. Have you heard about the exploit, Miles?
Yeah, I heard about that.
Any Adobe Acrobat prior to 9, I can't remember, has a vulnerability on all operating systems. I guess it only does Mac and Windows, that allows a buffer override. And there are out in the wild Trojans that use it to install. Now, what this means is, theoretically, if you don't have an upgraded version of Adobe Reader, and that's the app that actually launches PDF documents, you could quite easily, through any browser, Firefox or IE, you could load a page that PDF would then load Open Reader and then install applications on
your
computer.
But this is only for Acrobat for Windows, right?
No.
Because we're talking
the exploit is, but the buffer overrun is actually on there as well.
Right. I was just thinking they would have to make a PDF that would exploit a Mac version or an exploit that would
you are, you could theoretically, an Intel Mac, you could theoretically make an exploit that would bypass the operating system and start doing stuff. But they're not going to do that. No one's going to do that. That's too hard. So in any case, you need to, first off, who here doesn't like Adobe's Acrobat Reader?
The Adobe Acrobat Reader, in all fairness, has gotten a lot better. It was absolutely horrible. It's a big mountain of mud, but it has gotten better in my opinion.
Well, when you think about what they're doing, they're making a document universal. I remember working with the very first Adobe Acrobat Distiller. It was still in a beta mode, and I did a book for Agenda 95. And the thing took like 2 weeks to distill a book and turn it into a PDF. And now we're doing all this stuff in seconds. And, I mean, I think Acrobat, I think the whole Acrobat technology, it's pretty universal
and useful.
But that's
talking about PDFs. PDFs, there are many applications that will read PDFs. The PDF spec is one thing. The Adobe Acrobat program.
So you're talking about the reader and not the Acrobat Pro?
Yes, it's the difference between HTML and the web browser.
Okay.
Yes, all web browsers will read HTML, but they're separate things. So Adobe Acrobat, the program, has a problem reading PDFs.
Okay, PDFs.
Or it doesn't have a problem. It's just very, very slow at it.
Here's the thing that's interesting about it. Adobe says they're not going to fix it for a while, like a few months. which means
I thought
that
it was no later than March 11th.
Well, they're busy.
Oh, really? It's March 11th.
Yeah.
In any case, there's no fix for it right now, which means that if you want to keep reading PDFs, you should probably use a different reader.
Right. The issue being, well, there aren't – for Windows, you really do go to Adobe Acrobat, but
there's another one. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, but don't open – the thing is you can avoid it just by not opening up random PDFs. In other words,
but that's
don't
what
go,
I do on Sundays.
Yeah. In other words, don't go to random sites and start clicking on stuff. But you shouldn't do that anyway, so
thank you very much, Miles, for that nice clarity. Well, let's see, another call? Or yeah, we can do another call. What the heck?
So, I mean, that's a vulnerability vector, right?
Oh, we lost Pacific Grove. Man. Oh, Paso Robles, just as good. All right. Well, I wouldn't say that necessarily. I don't know. Ed from Paso Robles, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, I get a bunch of emails, and some of them I'd like to send to another individual, some of them. Mm-hmm. And is there any way to edit the emails, a email, you know, delete text from them?
Well, if you're going to, the one that you've received in, pretty much no, not without hacking to some degree, because the client doesn't want you to do that. It kind of is a record of what person sent to you. But you can you can forward it. Almost every email client allows you to forward. And once it's forward, you can actually start editing it. And then you can change what the person said, whatever, if you'd like.
So you could send it to a dummy account or something like that
and
edit?
Oh, do you want to save it yourself? Do you want to edit it and keep that, or do you want to edit and send it to somebody else?
Well, if I saved it, I could edit it then, right, from what you say?
My point is
what are you trying to do?
Yes. Are you trying to test whether it's possible to edit something, or do you want to change something and send it off to somebody else?
Well, I want to – change is a big word, especially nowadays. If you want to delete stuff from it, not necessarily add anything, is there any way of doing that? By saving it and then working on the save?
Well, here's the thing that's confusing to me is that from what I can perceive two reasons why you'd want to do this. One, you want to show that someone didn't send what they actually sent, and you want to be fictitious and kind of hack. And that means you want to receive an email, and you want to modify it, and then you want to print it out and go, hey, look, you didn't actually say that. That's one thing. That would be deceitful, but also possible. You'd have to do a little bit of hacking to do it that way. Not that complicated, but it's possible. The second thing you want to do is you like what somebody said, but you don't want all of it, or you want to change side of it, and then you want to go share it with your friend. Then all you have to do is push forward on the message, edit the way you want, and send it to your friend. That's it. So you've made a new email.
What was that first step?
Just push forward. In almost every email client, there's an ability to forward a message to somebody else. You just click forward. So you
push forward.
Forward. The other way to do it is just copy the text of the message, make a new message, paste it in, and edit away.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I would do it, probably. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's do another news story. What the hey, huh? Which one did I really want to deal with? Oh, yeah. What's up with this iPhone app and iTunes thing?
The presidents of the United States... who are a band, if you're not aware.
Sorry, wasn't hip enough there.
Have decided that they didn't want to sell their music over the iTunes Music Store. Or you may have a band that just doesn't have the clout to be able to get up there or something to that effect. So what they have done is had an iPhone application made that when the iPhone application is purchased, it has or is able to stream every song from every album that they've made. So they're making their money off of the app rather than through the music store.
It's
interesting.
It's four albums. I don't think it's every album they've ever made, right?
It's four albums plus some lost tracks or missing tracks.
It's three albums including... Oh, it's four albums and some earlier recordings that they did way back when. So, yeah.
How many albums do they have? I actually don't know.
I don't know. See, that's what I'm saying. They might have just four albums.
I'm not sure if I care. The general idea is that they want to give their music to people, and they don't want to have to use the iTunes store. So they're building applications, and Apple allowed the application.
Yeah, they allow the application in this case, and that's what I find interesting is that Apple has been very vigilant in stopping anyone who competes with their business model.
Are they selling these things through the phone?
Yes.
Ah.
The application is pay for.
So one application.
It's one application for a couple songs. If you want to buy their songs, you buy their application, and it gives them the songs.
So you can't store the song then. So
they're all streaming.
So you have to listen on your phone to the song.
Yeah, that's a little silly.
That's weird.
Or maybe you get an account and then you can go download
it. Maybe that's why Apple allowed it, is that it's not a direct competitor.
It's, yeah.
It's more like podcasting or like. It's not a rental service. You can download as often as you like. You just have to go to that app to do it.
Well, it's not downloading. It's streaming from the server. You can't listen to the music unless you're connected to some kind of network.
The audio stream is downloaded.
Wait a second. Or you download it and save it, and it gets saved, and you can play the app whenever you want.
No, it's not. Yeah. That's why I'm saying it's not caching the music.
That seems like a pain to me.
One of the apps that I like on the iPhone right now is called Public Media, and it just has different radio stations, and KSP's on it, for example. So anywhere in the world, if you have an iPhone, you can get this application. I think it's called Public Media, and then one of the stations is KSP's live stream, and you can even turn off the screen. You can't switch applications, but it still play. But it's pretty cool.
As a plug for that app, by the way, it's really great because no matter where you are, you can tell it find my location and give me the public radio station nearby me.
It's awesome because turning a radio on is just too difficult.
The radio also does that though.
As it turns out, when we were on a road trip, my girlfriend and I driving out to Sonora, the thing is you'll run, not only will you not be anywhere near a public radio station at some portions of the trip, but if you start off with one radio station, you'll end up out of that range. Mm-hmm. But instead, I put on the public radio app and then piped it through the tape adapter for the stereo, mm-hmm. which means that we can have the exact same story continuing for the entire trip.
Which station did you choose, though?
I think we had KQED. On that one, there was some program on that
you wanted to keep listening to, and it worked through while driving.
There were a couple of clips, a couple of places where it dropped out, signal dropped out a little bit too much for my phone. But overall, it worked very well.
It's like radio is changing or something.
I don't like this whole change thing.
Santa Cruz, Sebastian, welcome to Geek Speak.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have a business and. Ship a lot of stuff, and FedEx was noticed increased shipping and comped me a nice thermal printer, which I thought would be great. I'd save a lot of money on inkjet cartridges. But I have an iMac. And
they only support Windows.
I was wondering if I got boot camp, would I be able to load the Windows driver?
Absolutely.
All right.
But I'd try to do it in Parallels instead.
I'd use Fusion.
Or Fusion. So what we're talking about, boot camp actually says, let's take half your hard drive or part of your hard drive, not make it Macintosh, put Windows on it. And then whenever you want to go there and print something, you have to shut down and start up.
Right.
The problem would be is you're editing your documents. Okay, it's time to print on my cool new laser or my cool new thermal printer. And I have to shut down, put the thing, or I have to put the image on a memory stick. Then I got to shut down, open, reboot the machine. No, it's just a pain.
That's much better because I print my invoices out from a Mac spreadsheet.
So. Right. So go to what Al is saying. Well, it's going to be still kind of difficult. What you're going to do is you're going to print on the Macintosh. You're going to print a PDF. You'd save as PDF, and then you're going to open that on the Windows environment in Fusion or in Parallels.
I print off of the FedEx website.
So when you do a print on a Macintosh computer, you get the print dialog. You can click the print next, or you can do a save as PDF.
Yeah.
And it will actually produce a PDF document of exactly what would be printed. That file then can be printed by any PDF reader.
I'm thinking of a wrench in this works. Because
it's not fun, I'm saying.
No, after you get the virtual machine will not have the printer driver. The virtual machine will have a connection to a generic.
So what you do is USB, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so you have to do is you have to tell Parallels or Fusion, I'm assuming can do this, that that USB port is owned by Windows or owned by the virtual machine. And then the Mac doesn't handle the USB port. That's how you do it, Miles. So what Miles is saying is that the operating system actually has to be able to connect directly to the printer. And with Parallels or something, normally what you're doing is you actually use a virtual driver to use the Macintosh printers. But what you're going to do is you're going to kind of bypass that by assigning that USB port. It's a little complicated. Is Fusion free?
No.
Parallels, though, has a 30-day trial, I believe.
Well, they both do.
But then again, you have to have Windows, so you have to pay for that license.
Yeah, you still have to buy Windows. That's the thing. I mean,
I'd say get rid of this printer or try to get a driver that works on the Mac.
Yeah.
It's possible that their Mac
drivers. Well, they sell a driver that's supposed to work on the Mac, and I download the demo from Peninsula, is the company, something. And it is, I mean.
It's difficult.
You know, the demo has proprietary marks on it, but the label itself is really crummy graphic, so I don't think it really works.
wrong. Let me just say this, that normally if you've got a small developer producing something like this, you can contact them and say, I've got this printer, and they'll actually respond to you directly, and that's what I would do, is go, look, I'm okay with paying that, you know, a price for this thing, but I want to make sure it works. And just because the graphics are bad doesn't mean the driver's going to be bad. That's totally a marketing versus actual application. I got to go, unfortunately. Okay. Good luck. Let us know how it works. Okay. All right. There are a lot of support for strange printers on the Macintosh environment. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Arto, streaming live and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Car Talk on KUSP is coming up next in just another minute. And I want to let you know that you've been listening to Al Luckow. Al, thank you for being on GeekSpeak today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Oh, good. Miles Elam. Very busy on his phone and still on his Windows machine.
Always a pleasure.
Actually, it's Linux, right?
It's Linux.
All right. Miles, thanks for being here. And Ben Jaffe, thank you so much.
Certainly.
We may have Adam Savage on next week. He is traveling. We're going to have him on this week. It gets bent. And it might happen next week. I am not certain. But you know what? I promise that we will be on air next week. It will be an amazingly fun show. Just tune us in every Saturday at 10. And of course, if you're not podcasting us, please do podcast us. Go ahead and go into iTunes, click on the podcast store, search for GeekSpeak, you'll find us, and go ahead and subscribe to us because it helps boost our numbers and other people then find out about us. That would really be helping us out. So thank you very much. Coming up next is Car Talk on QSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. I have 15 more seconds. Miles? Anything?
We're through with being cool. We're through with being cool.
This syllabus is almost
over. Eliminate the ninnies and the twins.